Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, July 6, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar for today. This is the second of those three, A23-0060, Joyce Walsh et al. Versus Upshur Smith Laboratories, Inc. Counsel for appellant, I see there are three people that are seated at appellant's table. You will have, are you going to be splitting time?
No, Your Honor, I'll be arguing.
And your name is?
My name is Samuel Cole.
Okay. And have you been admitted to the Court of Appeals, pro Acevice?
I believe so. I am on the briefs, yes.
You are on the briefs, but did you, we don't have any submission under Rule 145.05 for your admission for oral argument.
Yes, sir. I will file that.
Okay. And do we have counsel here from Minnesota?
Yes, Your Honor. Brendan Flaherty is local counsel.
Okay. And normally we would have to have all this taken care of beforehand, but we can have, if he's going to be making the arguments, we can have you move for his admission pro Acevice.
Yes, I will do that and file any necessary paperwork right away.
Okay. So are you moving for his admission?
Yes, I am moving for his admission for oral argument.
Okay. That motion has been accepted.
Apologies, Your Honor.
Yep. Thank you. I just want to, we want to make sure we take care of everything, and we do realize that I realize that you were admitted to the district court. We do have a separate procedure for appellate court.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. And you'll have 15 minutes when we start oral arguments. Counsel for respondent, as you're well aware, you'll have 15 minutes for your arguments. And then counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. You may approach the podium when you're ready, and there is a button underneath to raise and lower the podium itself, as well as you can adjust the microphone. Please state your name for the record, the party you are representing, and with that, counsel, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Samuel Cole, and I represent the plaintiffs in this case. This is, at its heart, a simple case. The first issue in this appeal is whether generic drug manufacturers can avoid all liability under Minnesota state law simply by doing the bare minimum under a subset of federal drug regulations. The trial court dismissed all of plaintiffs' common law negligence claims simply because it concluded that defendant had done the bare minimum under federal drug regulations regulating consumer warnings. The Minnesota Court of Appeals, this court, and the Supreme Court have already answered this question unambiguously. Quoting from the Wendinger Farms versus Forest Farms decision, while a violation of a statutory duty may, in certain circumstances, constitute negligence per se, the inverse proposition that compliance with a statute precludes a finding of negligence is not the law. The Supreme Court, in the Blazing versus Hardenbur decision, quoted Prosser, torts, to say that the statutory standard is no more than a minimum, and it does not necessarily preclude a finding that an actor was negligent in failing to take additional precautions. In that case, it also involved a label. I think it was flammable paint and the extent to which it was flammable, and the defendant had argued that it complied with federal regulations. And the Supreme Court said, even assuming that this particular label, that is the federally required label, was affixed to the can in question, and there is evidence to the contrary, the fact that a person causing an accident has complied with a statute or ordinance regulating conduct under the circumstances is not conclusive that he was in the exercise of due care. Then after quoting that section from Prosser on torts, the court says, by this same reasoning, the failure to show that the defendants were in violation of an ordinance or statute does not preclude a finding of common law negligence.
So, counsel, I appreciate, and it's well briefed, your point of law that compliance with a federal regulation or even a state statute is the minimum standard of care. I understand that. What I'm struggling with is it doesn't seem to me that that's the reason that the district court granted summary judgment, a confusion about that point of law. Instead, seems to me, and this is what's argued by respondents, so I'm confident you're going to point out why I'm not understanding your position, is that at the end of the district court's decision, where the district court turns to whether there is, having determined that the defendant complied with federal regulations on the medication guide and getting that guide to the pharmacies. Whether there is still a claim, which is the one you're pursuing now on appeal, a claim as to the failure to provide warnings to physicians.
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district court's reasoning to me seems, you know, in a nutshell, on pages 36 and 37, which I guess addendum 84, 85, is that Upshur-Smith is not also required to show that it satisfied its duty to warn patients through another method, such as warning their doctors. Now, the district court here doesn't explain the reasoning so much. I have to go all the way back in the record to the motion to dismiss, where, you know, Judge Frazier analyzed that very specific issue and laid out some law, said Minnesota hasn't looked at this issue before, whether manufacturer has to both warn the physician and satisfy the obligation to warn pharmacies. But having looked at the law, Judge Frazier said, you know, it seems to me that that's what Minnesota would decide. So that's the legal issue I see in the case, and I don't see it briefed in your briefs. So I'm struggling with why you are so sure that's not the legal issue, when that seems to me the thread that ties together the summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor, and I'd be happy to answer that. And so in the trial court's decision on the second motion for summary judgment, it's very clear that she rejects plaintiff's argument that there is a reasonable requirement that is implied as part of the federal regulations. Plaintiff said several times that they must take reasonable steps to provide the medication guides to the plaintiff. And they provided lots of evidence from our expert's testimony that defendant did not take reasonable steps.
But the district court rejected the expert testimony because it said, you know, that goes to a different issue. What we're talking about here is, you know, the is there evidence in the record that those reasonable steps were not taken? In other words, is there any testimony, and the district court even opened up the record to allow further inquiry as to whether or not there are any statements or affidavits that are going to be filed by physicians saying, no, we did not receive any of this information. And so the district court dismissed, for a number of reasons, the expert testimony.
Yes, Your Honor. So there is two motion for summary judgment. And the first motion for summary judgment, the district court actually agreed with us that there was a genuine issue of material facts as to whether they had adequately warned the doctors. In the second motion for summary judgment, plaintiff responded based on how defendant itself framed the issue. And in its statement of the issues, defendant said, this motion presents a single issue. And they said, which is, did Upshur-Smith satisfy the requirements of 21 CFR 208.24B? And so when we responded to that second motion for summary judgment, we focused like a laser on that and argued that the federal regulation implied a reasonableness standard. And the trial court rejected that argument, that it implied a reasonableness standard. But only if it implied...
You've now abandoned your medication guide theory, right, as to the pharmacy?
Yes, right. Your Honor.
Okay, I see that in bold letters in your brief.
Yes.
So getting back to your theory as to the duty to warn physicians, I'm trying to understand what law supports your argument that if there is, where a manufacturer has adequately warned the pharmacy through the medication guide regulations, where is there the additional duty to also warn the physician? Because the core of this is the duty to warn is to the consumer, right? I mean, there isn't a, you know, you're not prosecuting a claim for duty, failure to warn a doctor or failure to warn a pharmacy. It all goes to the consumer, your clients, right?
Yes, ultimately it goes to the consumer, but the usual way to reasonably warn the consumer is by warning the doctor. And that is in the Mulder.
One way.
That is one way.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. That is one way. This might help make my point clear. If they had shown that they had taken reasonable steps to warn the consumers and the consumers had actually received the warning, that would be a break in the chain of causation.
But it's an either-or proposition. Either they took reasonable steps, including complying with the federal regulations, or they fail to warn the doctors. And if one is satisfied, isn't that enough?
Your Honor, if they took reasonable steps to warn consumers...
But wasn't that shown by them complying with the federal regulations?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so, not as...
Why not? Because, to Judge Bradfold's point, that's an issue that has been conceded, right? Why doesn't that end the case right there?
No, Your Honor. So how... Accepting the district court's interpretation of the federal regulations, the federal regulations do not require reasonableness. In fact, this came up again and again at the district court where we said, well, Your Honor, they're interpreting the means to produce medication guides just to mean anything useful to to providing medication guides, for instance.
So is your argument, well... I'm trying to understand your argument.
Yes,
I think I'm having the same struggle that Judge Bradfold is. You argue that there's a baseline, and I think case law is clear, and I think you cite that appropriately.
Yes, Your Honor.
But what more needs to be done under Minnesota common law to support your common law claim?
Yes.
Beyond complying with the federal regulations?
Yes, Your Honor, and that was litigated extensively at the district court during the second motion for summary judgment. For instance, they could have included clearer instructions to the pharmacies about distributing the medication.
What case law? Right, I understand you're arguing that they could have done more. What case law, what Minnesota binding case law supports a proposition that they needed to do more than just complying with the federal regulations?
Your Honor, I believe that, so Jones versus Medtronic is unpublished, but it's citing to a Pepin versus W.H. Brady Company decision, which is published. And in Jones versus Medtronic, it says, quote, Minnesota's common law requires a plaintiff to prove a failure to warn claim by alleging a manufacturer's failure to use reasonable care in giving ... a warning as to any dangerous, reasonably foreseeable its intended use. And so the Minnesota law that we're citing is just the general duty of reasonableness, and we believe that under Minnesota law that should generally be, whether or not they complied with their duty of reasonableness, should generally be a jury question regardless of whether they complied with the federal regulations.
Can I ask, just for framing again, getting back to this question, so the warning goes to the obligation runs to the consumer. One way in which it's satisfied sometimes is through the doctors, as you say.
Yes, Your Honor.
I just want to make sure I understood your last part of your argument. So as I read your briefs, it was that more was required to inform doctors.
Yes.
Once you conceded that the medication guide was complied, et cetera, and that goes through pharmacies to the
Yes, sure.
consumer. So what we're talking about is an additional obligation to tell more to doctors, right?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it's kind of both. They have to take reasonable steps to warn the consumer or the doctors. We are only appealing our doctors' claims.
Right. I'm looking at Section 3 of your brief, which is about adequately warning doctors, right?
Yes.
That's what we should be focused
Honor.
On right now.
Yes, Your
okay.
Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
So the question is whether they reasonably warn doctors, and that is actually the second issue in this case.
Can I stop you there? Because
you
just said manufacturer needs to do is take steps to warn patients or doctors. And you stated that in the disjunctive. And if warnings have been provided to patients, does it really matter whether or not there is a failure to warn physicians? Because doesn't the failure to warn physicians run to the patients? I mean, ultimately, it doesn't matter whether a physician or a pharmacist or any other, anybody else who's distributing has been warned. The key really is to warn the patients, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if the patients have been warned, what more, under Minnesota binding case law, needs to be done to warn? Why do you even need to show warnings to doctors then?
Yes, Your Honor. If they had adequately warned the plaintiff, then we wouldn't. Then they wouldn't need to show warnings to the doctor. But the court did not consider whether they had adequately warned the patients because that was not the issue that defendant put before the court. Defendant in the second motion for summary judgment said that the single issue is whether Upshur Smith satisfied the requirements of the federal regulations. And so when we responded on that, we were sticking with what defendant said was the single issue. And it's true that we interpreted the regulations in such a way that they would overlap with Minnesota law, because we said that the regulations require reasonableness. But defendant rejected that. They said, look, these regulations don't say that they have to take reasonable steps to provide the means to produce. These regulations don't say that they have to take reasonable steps to provide them to insufficient numbers to distributors. And they said, you know, reasonableness is beside the point, because the only question is whether we complied with the regulations.
But you did acknowledge and did argue that the federal regulations overlay and overlap with the Minnesota law. So why isn't satisfaction of the federal regulations, doesn't that satisfy Minnesota law as well?
Not if the federal regulations do not have a reasonableness requirement. And the court found that they did not. Following the federal regulations would only satisfy Minnesota law if they have a reasonableness requirement. And we argued that they did, and the trial court rejected that argument.
So, counsel, I see your time is almost up, and I just want to suggest to you at least something to consider for your rebuttal. So I'm interested in case law you believe indicates that Minnesota would hold that a drug manufacturer has a duty to warn the consumer reasonably. You're obviously claiming that, and that reasonableness would include a warning to the pharmacy as well as a warning to the physician. So a combined duty. It's clearly what you're arguing. And I just want the case law that you think best illustrates that that is a rule of law Minnesota would adopt,
yes,
or has adopted.
And would you like me to do this on rebuttal? Or
if you would. Thank
yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Kaynard Hunt, and I represent the respondent, Upshur Smith. Respondent Upshur Smith respectfully requests that the trial court's grant of summary judgment dismissal of this action against it be affirmed. As the court can see from the questions and the argument this morning, it's important to go back to the first ruling in this case. The ruling in the case began with the order ruling on Upshur Smith's motion to dismiss appellant's first amended complaint. That order is important because appellants were faced with the recognition, as other courts across the country have ruled, that their claims of failure to warn against Upshur Smith were federally preempted. So in addressing this motion, appellants asserted they did not seek a label change, stating the content of the FDA-approved warnings was sufficient. They also asserted their state duty to warn claims parallel rather than adds to or changes any federal requirements. State law claims are not parallel if the manufacturer could be held liable under state law without having violated federal law. Accordingly, and as plaintiffs argued at their motion to dismiss stage, their state law claim must be and was premised on the breach of a duty that is the same duty imposed under the FDA regulations. And I think it's important for the court to go back and look at page 18 and 19 of their memorandum in opposition to the motion to dismiss. Plaintiffs, in seeking to avoid dismissal, told the trial court, only when the manufacturer complies with the medication guideline regulation has the manufacturer exercised reasonable care in giving adequate and accurate instruction as to the use of the product and a warning as to any dangers reasonable foreseeable in the intended use. Plaintiffs stated they were citing from this court's decision in Jones, describing Minnesota's common law duty to warn.
And just to be clear, you're talking about Jones v. Medtronic, the non-precedential case.
Right, but it also cites a Minnesota Supreme Court decision for that proposition. Plaintiffs then said because their duty to warn claim is so limited, plaintiffs' claims alleging failure to warn under state law are no obstacle to enforcement of the federal regulation. There's never this argument of a negligence per se has never been the argument made by the plaintiffs until this court. What they've always argued is that if you comply with the medication guidelines in the distribution, that complies with Minnesota state law duty to warn.
Or did they just argue the inverse of that? If you don't, you failed.
No, they argued, well, they said if the only when you comply, then you've complied with the duty to warn. That's what they said, and we've complied, and they don't dispute that.
So is your argument then just, I think a lot of your argument was around forfeiture of arguments and sort of, if we just took this case from a complaint, or the First Amendment complaint or whatever, to the last summary judgment without intervening motions for a moment, and get to sort of like, okay, now at the end result, is there a claim that could be remaining when medication, for failure to warn, when the medication guides are complied with, that obligation?
And there is no claim remaining.
Okay, and there's no claim remaining. Why? Is one of the arguments I think asserted was, oh, you can't do more in a generic realm, but I suppose I don't know that it really violates federal law to send a doctor, hey, look at the medication guide.
There is some issue there because you don't have a change here and we're a generic manufacturer. But if you go back...
And just be clear, you're talking about a dear physician letter?
That dear physician letter, okay. Exactly. So if you go back and look at it, let's go back to the motion to dismiss and what Judge Frazier said. He said, well, the plaintiff's failure to warn claims can go forward under Minnesota law, and that the duty runs to the patient and the manufacturer satisfies that duty by providing adequate warnings to the patient, which is compliance with the medication guideline regulations, or satisfies it by providing the FDA warning to the physician. It's an or.
Right, so I want to know, why is that first part right? I mean, when I think of being a patient, yeah, sure, there's a medication guide, but I sort of assume my doctor knows what he or she is doing when he or she prescribes something to me. And so the argument seems to me, as long as that medication guide goes out to the patient, it doesn't matter that doctors were informed about serious risks of a drug, et cetera, even though they're the prescribers for it. And that seems a little bit, does it really fully comport with the manufacturer's obligation to fairly warn a consumer who's only going to get this through a prescription if they don't do enough information to the doctors?
I strongly disagree with that because, first, the federal regulations say to the pharmaceutical manufacturer, you have an obligation to provide the medication guidelines to the distributor. The distributor, i.e. pharmacy, then provides it to the patient. That's the federal system.
It's the federal system.
And that's the federal system, and that's what plaintiffs said. We're not asking for anything more than compliance with the federal system.
Pretend they hadn't said that. I'm trying to get away from a forfeiture argument, which I think is what you're getting to. They only argued one way, a strategic call.
But then we're going to have to then go back and attack Judge Frazier's order, which they have never asserted that the Judge Frazier was wrong in saying that under Minnesota law, the duty is you provide it to the patient, medication guidelines, or to the doctor. And Judge Frazier cited the Restatement of Torts Products Liability, Section 6D. Now, throughout this case, and we can't run away from the forfeiture argument either.
Well, I'm just wondering if you win absent forfeiture and how.
We win absent forfeiture because we complied with the medication guidelines. And if the court wants to go into the issue of whether we provided the FDA warnings to the physician, the answer is yes. The trial judge was wrong on that part of it in denying summary judgment on that grounds.
Right. Before you go there, counsel, can you win without going there?
Yes, I can win.
Okay, without going to the physician warning?
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
So, and I think that gets back to your point about the restatement that cited. by Judge Frazier and the on the order on the motion to dismiss?
Right. What he did is he.
I mean, Judge Frazier is pretty clear that this is not a rule of law that Minnesota has adopted. I don't know if you agree with that, because I didn't see it in your brief. So.
Well, we've had some disagreements with Judge Frazier throughout this case. But
yeah, and that's fine, counsel.
You know, we have accepted this is the realm in which we operate this case. And so that's the way we operated. So in the first motion for summary judgment, Upshur-Smith asserted, you know, we can meet summary judgment on both prongs. We don't need to, but we can meet it on both prongs. What the judge said there was, well, I'm going to deny you summary judgment as to the physician, but as to the medication guidelines, I'm going to find there's a material issue of fact, and not a material issue of fact, but allow them to conduct further discovery, which they did. We came back. What the discovery revealed is that we absolutely complied with the medication guideline regulations. They had nothing to counter that.
And I, if you don't mind, I would like to set the medication guide issue just aside for a moment. I mean, I realize that that's important to you, prevailing on appeal for you, but I'm very interested in your thinking about whether Minnesota has adopted, either implicitly or explicitly, the restatement that you've just cited, Section 6D, which sets out this alternative obligation to warn the consumer or patient through different methods, either the physician or the pharmacy, and it's not stated that way, but you know what I'm talking about.
Right. My problem is that, you know, the appellants haven't raised a challenge to Judge Frazier's reasoning.
So I appreciate that, counsel, right. And I mentioned that already, too. Okay. So it hasn't escaped my notice. Having said that, okay, if this court is going to write an opinion,
right,
it is not going to rely on the forfeiture of appellant's counsel. Okay. Or at least it is very unlikely, in my opinion. I'm only one of three judges.
Okay.
All right.
I am not aware of anything that would contradict Judge Frazier's reliance on the restatement of torts. And what he did is he did two things. He went to a dissent in a Sixth Circuit case applying Tennessee law and said, well, Minnesota law.
You're talking about the Chief Judge Cole dissent?
Yes.
Okay.
And then he then went to the restatement of torts and said, look, you know, Minnesota has adopted that generally in other circumstances, and I see no reason not to adopt it here. So that's what he did. So that was the structure of which this case proceeded. So when we went to our first motion for summary judgment, and we said, okay, this is our structure, we complied with the medical regulations, and we also complied with warning the physician. There was no dispute by the plaintiffs in response that that's not the framework, that that's not Minnesota law as applied to this case. Okay, it was only when we came back the second time, we made very clear in our intro to the second motion for summary judgment that, okay, we can show that they've done whatever discovery they wanted to do, which wasn't much, and that we have complied with the medication regulations, and therefore we're entitled to summary judgment, that it was an or. And so, again, in response
and
to...
And what's the case law you rely on for the or? Does it go back to the same case law that the district court cited? It's either the restatement or it's this dissent from the Sixth Circuit?
Yes, it is.
All right. Do we have any better authority on that proposition?
No. I mean, that was what came out of the order. But the problem, Your Honor, is okay. Let's say you disagree with Judge Frazier on the or. I mean, there isn't any material dispute on this record with regard to what Upshur-Smith did with regard to the physicians. I mean, the package insert, the prescription information accompanies every vial. It's the FDA warnings, and that's all we're talking about, that the physicians get the FDA warnings. They're in that package insert with every vial, and a lot of jurisdictions have said...
Well, 30 tablets or more.
And it was also available on, before a certain time period, it was on the physician desk reference, he had the physical. But everybody went to electronic. So you've got it on that. You've got it on various websites that are by the FDA. Specifically, if you look at, you've got the Daily Med is a national listing, drugs at FDA. And what's interesting about the plaintiff's complaint is they themselves acknowledge that's where doctors go. So, I mean, the pharmaceutical manufacturer can't do anything more than what it did here.
Let me ask you a question. Appellant's, I'm going to try to paraphrase appellant's argument, and forgive me if I don't get it quite right, but I think basically what they're saying is you've got the federal regulations, compliance with that, but you also have state common law, and state common law has this reasonableness requirement, and the federal compliance with the federal regulations doesn't have a reasonableness requirement. So therefore, those are two different and distinct requirements.
And that's exactly the opposite of what they argued to the district court to avoid preemption. They said that by...
And you're talking about preemption consistent with what other cases across the country
exactly. have. Exactly. So they were very clear to the... And you go to page, I think it's 18 and 19, of their response to the motion to dismiss, and they are very clear. Now, they have never asserted... What more would be required? What is this standard in the air? I mean, they haven't cited any case law, nothing. So this is the first time that we're really seeing this kind of argument because the argument always was by them, again, to avoid preemption, that it's reasonableness on the part of the manufacturer on the if you provide the guidelines in accord with the federal regulations.
One follow-up question on that. If we do get to that issue of reasonableness, does that invoke the preemption issue then?
I think you would have a preemption issue because that's what they were avoiding. That's how...
That's really hasn't been argued here at all.
No, it has not. And what Judge Frazier said, I'm giving you this kind of little skinny... you know, area to avoid preemption, and this is how you do it. And so you'd be back into preemption, and they've never argued it. See,
Can I ask about that? And maybe I'm in the wrong place, but in page 22 of that order, talking about failure to provide warnings to doctors, the decision reads, plaintiffs respond they are not asking for warnings additional or different from those already required by the FDA. They plead that Upshur Smith simply failed to provide FDA warnings to doctors. Failing to communicate warnings to doctors is barred by both federal and state law. This claim is not preempted. I mean, aren't they arguing that they need to, that state law comprehends that you would provide them to doctors, just what we're talking about here?
Well, but there's two. I mean, you can comply either by to the patient by the federal regulations
okay.
or separately a duty to the doctor. And like I said, I mean, it never has made any sense with this argument as to the doctor because the FDA warnings, and that's what we're talking about, that the doctor, there's no physician that's provided an affidavit. There's nothing in this record that any treating physician of any of the plaintiffs didn't get the FDA warning, not one. So, I mean, that's the kind of record we're talking about here.
I thought there was evidence that at least the six?
No.
There's no evidence.
No, what they testified to is that they did not get the medication guidelines.
And that's the patients, the six
patients.
Patient.
There's not one affidavit, not one declaration, not nothing from any treating physician in this case. None. And I ask that this court affirm the grant of summary judgment.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sorry. May it please the court. I wanted to start with answering your question. And so there really is not a lot of law in Minnesota on the duty to warn the plaintiff in particular. But there are cases, and these are cases that are talking about in the context of warning the doctor, that imply that reasonableness is generally going to be a question of fact. Jones, as I've already said, says that the duty under Minnesota common law is to take reasonable steps to warn. But Mulder also implies that. That is the Minnesota Supreme Court decision. In the Mulder decision, the manufacturer showed that they did the stuffers, which is another word for the package inserts, and put it in the PDR, and the plaintiff said, well, that didn't come to my doctor's attention. And the Mulder court did not stop there. The plaintiff did ultimately lose, but not for that reason. Instead,
Mulder doesn't look at this issue, though, of pharmacy warnings, right? Medication guides.
Not of pharmacy warnings. This is kind of a unique case in terms of talking about the medication guide warnings, especially in Minnesota. And so really we're just talking about the general duty to warn.
But in Mulder, the doctors actually admitted, the doctor admitted that he knew of the warning. So I don't think the Mulder case supports your position of an implied duty there.
Yes, Your Honor. And then Mulder, so we don't have any testimony from the doctors yet in this case.
But the district court provided an opportunity for you to get testimony from doctors, and there was none.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, in the first motion for summary judgment, we actually prevailed on the issue and the...
On what issue?
On the issue of whether there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether they had communicated adequate warnings to the doctor.
I'm not sure prevailed is the right word. I think The district court just said, it's still an open issue right now and allowed the parties to proceed to see whether or not there actually was an issue of material fact.
That was on the medication guide issue. The district court judge says, I'm going to allow more discovery on this issue. But on the issue of whether or not there was a genuine issue of material fact on whether they warned the doctor, the trial court did rule in our favor and said that there was a genuine issue of material fact on that and that plaintiffs would have to show at trial. Plaintiffs would have to show at trial that they warned, but there was a genuine issue of material fact because one, they did not put the labeling in the PDR at any time since 2006. Two, and this is actually coming to the third decision that I think supports our duty of reasonableness argument. As in Sheedon, there was lots of evidence from our expert that doctors were prescribing this drug for a use that was specifically warned against.
I was just going to ask, what's your data on the frequency of this off-label use?
Yes, Your Honor, that is.
And is it in the record for the purposes of summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor, for the first summary judgment, it was in the record in a declaration of Matthew Perry, I believe. Let me see. There we go. Approximately 1 in 6 community-based atrial fibrillation patients in a U.S. cohort were treated with amiodarone with significant site level variation. More than 2 out of every 3 patients treated with amiodarone as a first-line therapy appeared to be eligible for a different AAD. That's an arrhythmia. So atrial fibrillation is basically a heart flutter. It's not nearly as serious as ventricular arrhythmias. And these patients, 1 in 6 were of... atrial fibrillation patients were prescribed this, and more than 2 out of 3 patients treated with amiodarone were treated as a first-line treatment. This is a drug that up to 17% of people who take it get serious lung disease, and around 10% of the people who get that lung disease die. And so,
I hear you right, saying 1 of 6 people who suffer from atrial fibrillation
Yes.
That's the right thing. Not one out of six people who are prescribed this drug have atrial fibrillation. I just want to make sure.
No, this is, yes, that's the way that it goes. And this is in...
One out of six people with a condition get this drug, or one out of six people who get this drug have the condition?
One out of the six people with the condition get this drug.
With the condition. Okay, thanks.
Yes, sir.
I just have one last question.
Yes, sir.
If we were to accept your argument that you're making on appeal now, don't you run into the preemption issue?
No, Your Honor.
Why
and I'm
not? Because that seems to be what you've been trying to avoid, which has come up in many other cases across the country, and the district court actually discussed that issue.
Yes, Your Honor, and I would I'm actually really glad you brought that up, because I had it in my notes here to raise it myself. Can I please answer this question?
Briefly, we're out of time. Yes.
Okay. Briefly, no, Your Honor, it does not. There are three preemption doctrines that are at issue in prescription drugs case, in prescriptions cases. That is the mincing decision, which is saying that generic drug manufacturers cannot use language different than the name brand manufacturers. We have never complained about the language of the warnings. Our argument has always been a failure to communicate the warnings. There is Buckman preemption, which has to do with interfering with the FDA administrating its rules. You know, communicating these warnings to doctors would not interfere with the FDA's regulatory authority at all. It has nothing to do with the FDA. In the Buckman decision, they were actually suing based on fraud to the FDA. And so the Supreme Court found that interfered with the FDA's regulation. And finally, and this is very important to clear up, there's express preemption. But express preemption only applies to medical devices. In Wyeth versus Levine, the United States Supreme Court noted that and said that only medical devices are subject to express preemption. They did not do that for drugs.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Thank you both for the briefing and the oral arguments. Both of them were very well done. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory.
Thank you.
Thank you all.